I was just bragging to Doug yesterday. I said, you know that I didn't know anything about PowerPoint. And you can't believe it, but I learned it in 1 hour and put together this whole presentation. He said, you know, that's pretty impressive. Just 1 hour, huh? I said, yeah, it's nothing. You know, it was. Yeah, I know. I mean, maybe for some it might have taken a lot longer, but for me, it was 1 hour. Well, so I made the mistake of having my daughter, who's sitting over here to the left of me here, at that conversation, and she says, she doesn't know her place yet, she says, Dad, PowerPoint, I mean, look, even professors know how to do that. I mean, it's like saying I learned how to, you know, sit on a bar stool or something. I mean, it's just pathetic that you would brag about this. So anyway, lots of things are not impressive to the young that are impressive to the old. The title of the talk is Mises' Monetary Mania, which I must admit to you, Pat Barnett had written me and said, what are you going to talk about? And at our next conference, I had no idea. So I just sort of made up this title. You know, just kind of stuck it out there. It's kind of got three M's and it seems sort of cool. And I didn't know really what the content was going to amount to. Well, sometimes it's nice to give yourself a title like that and then force yourself to come up with a talk around it. I mean, at least it works for me. And I think it works this time because what I've done is gone through lots of things on the website that relate to the topic of money. But before we get to that, I want to kind of give you a brief history of the website, which I think is tremendously fascinating. We're living in a very interesting age, all of us, in which the digital media has just utterly and completely transformed the way information is distributed around the world. And this is very exciting for us, for any movement dedicated to ideas and to the notion that ideas are the stuff that really move history forward. And so this is Mises' view, and it's our view, and so digital media has been for us an amazing thing for a variety of reasons I would like to talk to you about. In particular, the area of money is an interesting one because, did you notice this, until very recently hardly anybody seemed to care much about this topic, particularly about central banking. You know, we've been talking about this subject ever since our founding. Our first conference in 1982 was on the gold standard, and everybody thought it was kind of a crazy idea. Why are you talking about this subject? It doesn't. And have you had this experience where you're trying to explain something about economics to people and you raise the topic of money and its quality and its soundness and you see that people don't, you know, for the most part, have never thought about it before, you know? And it's really true that you need an institute like the Mises Institute to constantly harp on the topic and sponsor scholarship on it and publish writings about it. Otherwise, it goes completely ignored until it's too late, like the German hyperinflation or something like that. So, you know, this is what the Mises Institute has been doing ever since our founding in 1982. We've been publishing on the topic. And, you know, when the whole crisis hit last year, it was a marvelous thing because we had this huge infrastructure already in place about the topic of money and banking. And we were there and nobody else was. And as a result, our books took off and the Mises Org traffic soared and we had everything in place. And at that moment, I was deeply grateful to all the people who had supported us for all those previous years, even though it seemed like we were doing sort of weird, cranky, irrelevant stuff. You know, like, what are we doing? Why are we writing books about the gold standard? Why do we have this constant harping on the problem of central banking? Well, they knew and we knew that there would come a time when this would be crucial not only to the topic of economics, but to the very survival of civilization itself. So, you know, you have to think ahead. So I put together this little presentation that's a little bit of a history of the website, which today, let me tell you why it matters. Mises.org is easily, it might in fact be the largest nonprofit website in the world. It certainly is in the area of economics. The traffic is immense. I've been following the analytics tables for years on the website. They're really too big for one person to even keep up with. There's just so much usage. And it's all over the world, all kind of age groups. The demographics are extremely broad and we have no close competition at all within our sector of the world. I mean, just simply at all. It's immense, which is an interesting thing that it could be such a highly trafficked website that's just devoted to this seemingly narrow topic of the Austrian school. So I'd like to just show you, with a little bit of help from the Wayback Machine, you know, nothing you ever post on the Internet ever goes away. You know, it's always there. So you can go through the Wayback Machine and find out anything. So I found out a lot of the history of Mises Org here. In the early days of the World Wide Web, I'm dating it from 1995, with the invention of the web browser, which is when this stuff was really became possible. And incidentally, that was the year that Murray Rothbard died. And it was also the year that his writings of a lifetime really took flight. And are now, I mean, he's a more popular writer than he ever was in his life. He is today. So anyway, in the early years of the World Wide Web, people thought of the website as a kind of a billboard, which isn't a bad thing. So I just kind of put this little 1950s ad up there. It's not really actually delivering gasoline. It's just sort of advertising the existence of gasoline and sort of promoting it. And that's the way we thought of Mises Org as being. You know, you just kind of put up a billboard as a way of telling people that you exist. Now, it's hard for us to remember this, but before the advent of the World Wide Web, there wasn't any way to find out about the existence of the Mises Institute at all. You know, you had to kind of scrounge around the libraries and go through Social Science Research Index or something, which in fact is the way I found out about it. Sometime in the mid-1980s, I found out about a periodical called The Free Market this way. Just digging through this hard copy stuff. It was very difficult to get the word out. You had to get it out through mails, and it was hard to, you had to advertise in print publications, which is very expensive in those days. So just to have a billboard was a great thing. Oh, I gave another example of an advertisement here, just as a kind of way of illustrating the way advertisement can work, you know, a billboard. So this is our first website. This is our first website. Have you ever seen this before? How many of you have seen this before? No. Oh, there we go. Hey, fantastic. Ah, yeah. So that was it. That's our first website. So we had, you know, information. We had, you know, here's a list of conferences of how to get fellowships and a list of publications, no actual publications. Something about how to join us, you know, I don't know, what did it say? Call our number, I guess that's what it said. I don't know. Feedback so you could actually like send an email. You know, very exciting stuff. In those days, it was huge. The big moment came for us in the next incarnation of 1996 because we realized for the first time, as I said earlier, the advertisement about oil delivered just information about Chevron, not the actual gasoline itself, and the advertisement about vodka there didn't just told about the vodka, didn't give the vodka itself. Okay, so now we began to realize after the website went up that we didn't just have to advertise our existence, we could actually give them the stuff that they wanted. We could give them the gasoline, we could give them the vodka, you know, I mean, this is the real thing. So here we have, over here, we can use the pointer, right? Yeah. So here we have the free market. So we started publishing our actual publication here. This is a very interesting thing. Even to this day, it's very controversial. Like many old-line publishers are thinking, well, if we make it available digitally, nobody will ever buy our book. So we can't possibly do that. You know, it's against our fiduciary interest, you know, to do this. As a charitable organization, there's an organization totally dedicated to getting the word out. This is never a problem for us. But of course, we're going to give away. I mean, if somebody wants to read the stuff that we're producing, then we're going to make it available through this medium. It wasn't a controversy at all for us. It seemed to be like just something that we should just do. And it was very exciting for me because in the early days of the Mises Institute, mostly what we did was photocopy articles and send them through the mails. I mean, we'd answer the phone, somebody wanted a certain article that they had read, you'd go and make a photocopy of it, you send a copy in the mail. You know, that was a large part of the work. I mean, it was just kind of getting the information out. Now we had a way to actually distribute our material online. And I guess maybe even from this vantage point, in 2009, it's difficult to understand how revolutionary this was. I mean, it was sort of like the invention of the printing press. I don't know what else to compare it to, but it was an amazing thing to be able to send the stuff that we're actually doing through digital media, through an email or whatever, and just draw attention to it online, solving all the problems of hard copy. So it was an amazing thing for us. And it gave rise to new insights. And here I just want to discuss briefly the significance of what it means to have things delivered digitally. And I think this is a very helpful exercise to go through to try to understand that the world includes two types of goods. On the left-hand side, we have scarce goods, and on the right-hand side, non-scarce goods. And this is the two kinds of goods there are in the world. And let me just kind of march through this a little bit. Under scarce goods, there's not enough goods to satisfy all needs. That's essentially what scarcity means. Right? There's a finite number. So after they're produced, they must be apportioned out, and they have to be conserved somehow. I mean, scarce goods would include like the lunch we had, you know, the cheesecake we had for dessert here, you know, the glasses, the tablecloths, everything you see physically in this room, and most all goods in the world. This allocation requires private ownership, lest there be overutilization. If things aren't owned privately, then they'll be consumed and they'll be gone, which is essentially the story of socialism, right? Overutilization of resources leads to calamity. Private ownership permits trades from whence prices emerge. So you have exchange ratios as you trade private property back and forth, and these prices permit comparison of heterogeneous goods and services. So you can develop a cost accounting ledger. And discover the priorities associated with production and allocating goods. This is the essence of what Mises discovered is the key to the market economy. For all scarce things, you have to have the system in place. If it's not in place, it leads to disaster. That's why socialism can't work, and that's why medical socialism can't work. It's why the post office doesn't work. It's why the public schools don't work. It's why all public organization of anything doesn't work right, because you have scarce resources attempting to allocate it not through a price system but through administrative decrees or collective ownership or some other bureaucratic arrangement that ignores pricing signals and the need for rational allocation of resources. All of the stuff on the left is what you learn when you study economics. The stuff on the right, slightly different. Non-scarce goods. Now, they might have to be produced. They may or may not have to be produced. But they certainly can be in need of production. But once they're produced, they don't need to be allocated or conserved. They can be, they can be one simultaneously or by one or all. Sort of. I think that's supposed to be owned. They can be owned simultaneously by one or all, unless artificially restricted. One person can own it, or everyone can own it. They can be shared and copied infinitely without reducing the quality of the original. Cost accounting might be necessary in the delivery, but not in the goods themselves. So there's no calculation or problem associated with non-scarce goods. So you're probably wondering, what would be an example of a non-scarce good? I have one. Oh, let me just illustrate that I'm not deviating here from Austrian theory by drawing attention to the existence of non-scarce goods. Mises called them the free goods. A factor of production may consist in the control of technological knowledge required for production. The recipe, for example. Such recipes are, as a rule, free goods, as their ability to produce definite effects is unlimited. So he draws attention to the fact that certain kinds of knowledge knowledge required for production is an example of a free good. Potentially limitless distribution, infinitely reproducible. An example. I have listed as fire as an example of a non-scarce good, because you have one small flame, but if I take another candle to that, I get another flame, but it doesn't reduce the quality of the original at all. It can be infinitely extended without ever taking away the integrity of the original flame. So on the bottom is this huge fire, some kind of volcanic thing on fire, and at the top is one small flame. So fire is an example of a physical but non-scarce good. So you don't need economics to allocate fire. So you don't go to the store, I'd like to buy some fire today. That doesn't happen, right? You can buy lighters, or you can buy fuel for fire, all these things, but the fire itself is not a good that's bought and sold. Do you see what I mean? Yeah, okay. So the kind of non-scarce good that Mises sort of deals with is information. It's the thing that Mises himself talked about. It's knowledge. And knowledge is potentially infinite. By the way, the more I think about this, there's a slight mystical aspect to it. Anytime we think of sort of famous miracles in human history, they always seem to involve the taking of a scarce good and turning it into a non-scarce good. So there's this scene where there's a big crowd and Jesus is speaking before them, you know. And I guess a long speech or something. Lunch comes. Everybody's dying of hunger. They start complaining. What are we going to have? There's no food. And a couple of his followers show up and they have some loaves and fishes. So, you know, Master, this is all we have. We can't possibly feed the multitude with these little things. Something happens. We don't entirely know what. And there's enough loaves and fishes for the entire multitude and there's some left over. Miracle. It's a miracle. You take a scarce good, turn it into a non-scarce good. Something similar happened, I think, earlier in the series of miracles here. There's that scene at the wedding, you know, the wine's running out. And then Jesus sort of comes up, I guess people, I don't know, into water, into barrels or something, he turns it into wine. So he's taking what seems like a scarce good and turning it into a non-scarce good. It's a miracle. Well, so, you know, there's an element of digital media that shares in these qualities of this capacity for infinite reproducibility. And we experience this anytime you send a file to anybody through email, you know. You've got the file on your computer, you upload it in your email, you attach it, you send it off to them. They've now got an exact duplicate of your file. Your file still exists on your hard drive, but they have now one too. And how many times can this be repeated? 10 times, 100 times, 1,000,000 times, an infinite number of times it can be repeated without ever diminishing the original owner's ownership over what he has. Everybody has copies, exact copies, the same exact thing. So it's infinitely multiplied. This is the essence of what digital media is all about. And for us, for Misesians, for people who believe in the power of ideas, this was everything to discover this. So the website continued to expand. We had a book catalog, free market, this is 1997. And here we started, this is the only generation of the website that was ever sort of left flush. I became obsessed with this as the years went on. No matter what else happened, the website had to appear in the middle of the page. That caused a lot of design problems as the years went on. But anyway, this is the one compromise. So we started delivering the Austrian Economics Newsletter, the Free Market, the Mises Review, the Mises Memo. Everything we possibly could put online, we started putting online. Everything in HTML so far. PDFs were a little bit too heavy back in those days. It was hard to deliver things with too much memory, because that, of course, computer memory itself is a scarce good. The good that you're delivering through the medium of the website is non-scarce, but all the stuff associated with the delivery itself is scarce. 1999, we started. This is back when websites were sort of, there wasn't the big wide screens, you know, so this looks a little ridiculous. But in those days, it took up the whole screen. I think that's 750 pixels we kept it at, right in the middle of the page. And that was a total redesign. We started adding coming events and news, and we had the book catalog, and then we had a very primitive store that worked for, you had to take the afternoon off just to order a book or something, you know, nothing worked right. But, you know, that's the way it was in those days. And started running articles every day. 1999, this is only 10 years ago. How quickly time is moving, isn't it? It's amazing what times we live in. Another generation, we started adding more and more content here. See this? 8 books by delivered by Mises. And we're very fortunate. Most of Mises' works have fallen into the public domain, which is another way of saying that the state does not restrict your access to them. You know, that's all that really means. So that's what public domain means, you know. It means like a free market or something close to it, right? So Mises' books, and you know how blessed we are, because, you know, if these books had been published any time between 1964 and the present, they'd be owned by some, you know, mega publisher, you know, be restricting your access to them, you know, but they're all written before then. And fortunately, they were published by institutions that didn't really care that much about his work, and so they didn't renew them. So most of them fell into the public domain. It was a great gift to the world, fortuitous for Mises and for us. Started putting them all online, one after another. It was hard work. You can see the expansion here. I think this is 2001. I think we get now here our first media files that appear on the site. Those were very heavy in those days, and they drained a lot of bandwidth. Bandwidth was very expensive. We were paying high bills for downloads in those days, and we had very few things. We went from just these small, they're very small clips, you know, like 2 minutes of Murray speaking, not even that, sometimes 20 seconds. And Mises speaking, which was a great thing in those days. 2002, we started expanding the width of the website, adding ever more content. I had absolutely no organizational sense in my head. You know, things just began to pile up, so it just became a huge list of everything possible I could think of. Anything that was on the site got its own hard link, you know. And then Chad was busy creating all these infinite graphics. I think the page went down for another 15 feet down here, you know, with these graphics. Then we got a blog, you know, and couldn't find anything, but, you know, this way it was. And so Ever Wider 2004, I started expanding the width of it, gave the header a nice high-tech look that was fashionable in those days, you know. And then 2005, ever more development. I'm showing you just the front page. We have to understand that behind this, of course, it's like a city. You know, the city of Mises.org, you know, went from like New York in 1820 or something to, you know, to the way it looks today in just this period of time, because then we could spend endless hours here. And during this time, too, we started recruiting ever more students, as you could imagine, because students around the world are Googling around and running into Mises. I mean, this is the way I found Mises. You know, I was just an economics major at Texas Tech University. I loved economics. It's fine. It's a wonderful subject, you know. If I study it long enough, surely I'll find all the secrets to civilization in these among these graphs. And then at some point, somebody pointed me to a book by Mises, and the whole world just opened up. It's a glorious thing to bump into, you know, an economist of his range and his substance, and talking about the real stuff, the stuff that really matters, and he seems to have it on everybody. And that's all we really need to do is highlight the school of the thought, and attracts people to the school. It began to expand ever more. We had this fun quiz that, you know, everybody took, are you an Austrian? You know, you take it, and if you're 100% Austrian, you know, then that's a great thing or something. People would write us, I remember when they would first start taking the quiz, they'd say, could you please change my score? You know, I didn't really understand question three. Yeah, I really meant to answer B, not A, as if we're keeping track, you know. Yeah, well, we'll change that in the ledger, you know. We'll appeal. It's very strange. Oh, we began to get great gizmos like, I remember one time David Vexler, who's the actual webmaster of Mises.org, came to Auburn. He said, look, I want to do something big, something glorious. And I said, well, I just don't know what that would be. He said, well, how about a little widget that displays a random quote by Mises? So I said, okay. So we put together a database of thousands of small quotations by Mises that you can run anywhere. And websites all the world run this thing now. It's over here in the corner. That's the first time that thing appeared. And it also began to illustrate to us the power of RSS feeds. And eventually, of course, we began to drive the whole site by its digital feeds, not so much hard-coded, so I wasn't in there, you know, every second of the day. Now, you know, the site would more or less run itself. And this was the first big feed site. I mean, this was a little bit hysterical because absolutely everything on this page was generated by feeds, and it went all the way down to the bottom. So, you know, this was 2 years ago when it really became more and more common to have everything under feeds. It's like ancient history now, 2 years ago. And you could drag and drop these. This is also a big thing, drag and drop. You had to drag and drop. Everything had to be drag and drop. If you couldn't drag it and drop it, it was just useless. You know, that was the view. So everything on this page, you know, moved around. You could move it around. You could put the Mises blog post on top and the article down. Why anybody would want to do that, I don't know. But, you know, that we had some sense. Finally, things began to stabilize. Previous year, and I'm sorry this thumbnail is missing. Wayback Machine couldn't grab it. I don't know. It probably because it had a relative link. But anyway, this is our first incarnation of the new site where we had an actual design team, not just, you know, sort of me working on Saturday morning or something with a couple of guys. We had an actual design team come in and show us how to make something really beautiful, and then we end up with this all the way today. And that's the current site, which, as you can see, has a vast number of things. One of the things we put up over here is this this community right here. You know, you dig into this, it's another world. Forums and a chat room, you know, it's really fun to go in the chat room late at night, you don't have anything to do, so you go in the chat room, everybody greets you like a star, hey, there you are, and you know, you kind of chance. So, the big crowd hanging out there all the time. Some data, I see that you can't actually see this data very well, so I maybe I'll just blast past this. I tried to blow it up here. This is the Mises sword compared to the Federal Reserve. We've been in a constant race here, you know. You can see that we kind of passed them, you know, once the crisis hit, you know, they kind of went down. And here we are, Mises versus Brookings versus the Federal Reserve versus the National Bureau of Economic Research, you know. Killing them across the board. Okay. I don't know, you know, I had so many wonderful things that I would like to go through with you here. I'm just going to click through some of these things. I'm told they have exactly 5 minutes here. I have like 50 slides. I mean, you know, if I do like one every 3 seconds, maybe we can actually blast through it. I just want to show you some of the books we have online, which there are thousands. And do you understand what this means? It's a full text of these books that in the old days, you know, you're so fortunate to find them in the library. Now it's just like, you know, a couple of quick search. We're now running our own Google, internal Google search engine. You know, we have a box, a Google box running on our site. Not Google itself, but our own Google box, you know, that renders all these PDFs in text. So you can copy and paste out of all of them. Every single PDF has a complete table of contents on the left. And every one of them is fully searchable. I thought I would put the first book up. And as I say, we have thousands. I'm just displaying the ones that discuss money and banking here. First one, all of Austrian economics always begins with Principles of Economics by Karl Menger. He discusses the origin of money, not in terms of social consensus or state decree, but emerging out of the market. This is a book by William Gouge, or Gouge. Gouge, I guess, is 18, what is that, 39? I can't quite read it. But one of the hard money banking theorists of the American tradition that Tom DiLorenzo was talking about. And again, a book that nobody's ever heard of. Now it's available to the whole world. Ron Paul talks a lot about this book in the Fed. Another 19th century banking treatise, blasting fractional reserve banking and the tendency. You see how the table of contents are on the left? One click and you're in. This is a 1917 book that we just found the other day, Our Money in the State. You know, we make these discoveries, like, huh, who knew this existed? This is a great book. Who ever knew? And then you scan it, you put it online, infinite distribution. And by the way, the entire website is open source. So anybody, anywhere in the world, can download the entire website and run it themselves on their own servers. We do this. So there are hundreds and thousands and hundreds of thousands of copies of all of this stuff running on servers all over the world, so that if something terrible happens, you know, so that, you know, our server facility in Dallas blows up or something, it's not going to make any difference to us. Mises Org's out there and will be until the end of the time. This is part of, I think, the moral obligation of our generation. We have a chance now to liberate all of these works for all time. After we're all gone in this room, people will still be using these editions. Still. I mean, they're perfect. 300 DPI, every one of them is flawless. Any one of them can be downloaded and published instantly. A Bubble of the Broker World, Garrett's prophetic treatise, 1934, explaining the Great Depression. Who knew? Value of Money. This book had a huge influence on George Selgin and Leland Yeager and their monetary theory. Nobody had even heard about it until, you know, a few weeks ago when it went online. Hayek's great book, we're cooperating with the Institute of Economic Affairs to put all of Hayek's work online. All of Murray's work on the Federal Reserve. This is an 800-page. How many pages is that? No, it's not 800. It's 542, I think it says. All of Hayek's greatest work on business cycle theory published last year. This is a case where we put it online before it went into the hard copy. You know, we still sell the hard copy, by the way. This is a master's thesis written under Murray Rothbard on history of bubbles. By Douglas French, and we like to keep up his original type manuscript just for old time's sake. It's also published in hard copy. Ron Paul's The Great Prophet of Our Age, all of his speeches from Congress. Look at this. Anybody know what that is? That's Mises' 1912 treatise on money. 1912. You couldn't get it. And now there it is. The original German, 1912. I mean, I don't even think you couldn't pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for a hard copy of that. Now it's online. Benjamin Anderson's great work from the 1920s. Vixell, we're the only publishers of Vixell's work on money and interest rates in the world. Value of Money, fantastic attack on quantity theory of money, showing that it actually the world doesn't work according to that formula. An explanation of how the French Revolution took place due to fiat money inflation. The Theory of Money and Credit, the first English translation in the 1950s, now available to everybody. This is a book we published just 2 years ago, Money, Bank, Credit, and Economic Cycles, the most comprehensive book on Austrian business cycle theory and monetary theory ever, and it remains just the definitive treatise. 900 pages, all there for you. What Has Government Done to Our Money? Probably the best-selling book on money ever written by Murray Rothbard. Now in its 137th edition or something like that. When the crisis hit, this book, A History of Money and Banking in the United States, was an unexpected bestseller. Mises' essays collected into a single volume. This is the book in which Mises predicted the Great Depression. We put it up in German. Also in English. But this is Condé Verguet, another one of those great hard money 19th century American theorists that everybody's forgotten about. He's not forgotten anymore. A wonderful book. Bob Higgs the other day said this is the best book on business cycles he had ever read, and he had never even heard about it until he read this online edition. Larry Seacrest wrote this book. It was on the verge of, death through obscurity. And he gave us permission to put it online. It's a great attack on central banking. And we got permission from him to put it online, so it wasn't trapped under copyright anymore. And he saw it online. We put out a hard copy edition. And then he tragically died of a heart attack. But there he stands, immortalized. Another 19th century defense of free banking. Hayek's Free Market Monetary System. This book, Mystery of Banking, which our donors made possible that we republished, came out just in the nick of time, just as soon as the banking crisis hit last year, and suddenly Rothbard was flying out the door. Gold is Money, Hans Sinholz. Here's one of Murray's favorite economists, Edmund Kemmerer from the 1940s, explaining why we should better go back to our gold standard. We're going to face hyperinflation in the future. This man was a prophet. Here's our book from the 1982. One of the best books in the Federal Reserve ever written, Elgin Grossclose. That makes for some harrowing reading, I tell you. And Murray Rothbard's Broadside Against the Fed. And then Ron Paul's Case for Gold comes out of the Gold Commission. And I think I'm just going to have to stop. Let me just kind of... From Britain Versus World Inflation, Inflation Crisis, How It Resolved. There's Murray's book, Panic of 1819. I put this one up just to let you know we have thousands of journals articles up there, too. Gottfried Hobler explaining the Austrian business cycle theory. There's Mises' collected essays on the Great Depression. John Robbins, Tom Woods loves that book. Murray Rothbard's great treatise, Wim Rupke, and that's it. That's just a slight look at Mises' work. That's like, 0.005%. So, thank you.